Thank you, Weston. Did you pick that song, Empty Nest? You made it up? Really? And you gave it that title, Empty Nest? Well, that's good. That's synchronistic because that kind of leads right into what we want to talk about this morning. We have the empty nest, you know, Mother Nature. It seems kind of cruel to us, but Mother Nature, when the birds are old enough to fly, she kicks them out. And they fly or they don't fly. That seems kind of cruel to us, but we have this phenomenon in our culture today called re-nesting. And you all know what I'm talking about, but I can't point the finger because I re-nested when I was 27 years old. I moved back in with my parents. I was between places. And so I moved back home, and, you know, my parents were really nice about it. But anyway, so empty nest, that's good. I know I'm not competent to talk about motherhood. So I'm taking my advice from mainly two sources. One is Jane Harrison. She was a historian, anthropologists, that kind of thing. She studied mainly Greek religion, and she went behind Homer's Olympus and did research into Greek religion before Homer, and it was full of goddesses, she discovered. It was all about goddesses. Her book is Prolegomena to Greek religion, and if you want to read it, it's a good book. It's real thick. The other person is Esther Harding. And she really is the inspiration behind this message because several years ago I read her book, Psychic Energy, Its Source and Transformation. Esther was born in 1923 in England, and she studied at the Women's School of Medicine in London. But then she moved to America in the 70s and practiced Jungian analysis until 1971 when she died up in New York City. And so I want to read an excerpt from her book, and the title of this particular chapter is Maternity. In our present day culture, the aspect of maternity, symbolized by the great mother, slumbers unrecognized. Mothers are usually kind and loving to their children, and their attitude of self-sacrifice is proverbial. It is our mode to be quite sentimental and uncritical about this relationship. We speak of sacred motherhood, and we even have a Mother's Day, on which in some circles every son and every daughter is expected to send a gift to his or her mother. I do it. Always have. The attitude, though, seems to be that beyond the demands of personal relationship, there is a need for a general recognition requiring, so to speak, a collective push, a united effort to remember not my mother or your mother, but just mother. It is a generalization of the personal feeling that results in a deterioration of the filial emotion to sentimentality. A woman who accepts the homage and the gifts offered to her on Mother's Day and takes to herself the prestige and honor that really belongs to the maternal role she has filled has identified herself with the archetype. Although her individuality seems to be enhanced, this conscious superiority is compensated and nullified in the unconscious, for she has become nothing but mother. And her personality is sacrificed to the archetypal image that usurps the place of her individuality. If this homage were rendered, quite frankly, to the mother in a religious spirit, it would have quite a different significance. It would then be a ritual whose aim and effect would be to cut the tie to the personal mother and to strengthen in its place the relation to the non-personal mother, the magna mater, the great mother, source of all of life. The mother may have reached a personal development that would allow her to give up her bondage to her child. But unless the son or daughter undergoes a corresponding development, he or she will not be able to relinquish his or her childish clinging to the mother. For it is far easier to remain a child than to launch out into the perils that independence involves. And so it is necessary for the child also to undergo an initiation involving a ritual of sacrificial death. By this, he or she dies so far as the personal mother is concerned and is thus released from his childish dependence on her and is reborn a child of the universal mother, who is earth mother, the mother of his physical body, and becomes by this act the mother of his spirit, for she is also the heavenly mother. So in one sense, we have an earthly mother, we have a heavenly mother. And so I want to talk about that this morning with you. Oh, the other book I wanted to mention is called The Great Mother by Eric Newman. So this is a man writing about mothers. So I'm like, okay, take it with a grain of salt. There's a very old story that comes out of the First Fertile Crescent about the time 3000 BCE. It's one of the oldest creation stories known. The title is Enuma Elis. At that time, now this is what scholars say, historians say, about that time, Akkadian people from the north invaded the Fertile Crescent, and they were warrior tribes, and they took over the people who were living there, the Sumerians, and they built their culture on top of the Sumerians, so they told their stories and their creation stories. And this Enuma Elis comes out of that situation. The story describes how Marduk, a god of light, is sent to do battle with a great big female dragon, Tiamat. How many of you know the story? Have you heard of the story? Tiamat is a great big female dragon, and her desire is to suck. She's kind of like a black hole. Her desire is to suck all light back into the black hole. So they believed in black holes back in those days. So Marduk, the god of light, goes to do battle with Tiamat. She opens her mouth to suck him in. He takes out his bow and arrow. He shoots an arrow. It goes straight into her mouth, right into her heart, and kills her dead. She dies. He takes his sword out. He cuts her body in half. He makes one half of it the heaven and the other half the earth. When, by the way, Tiamat had a little consort named Kingu. And so Marduk splits her body in half, makes the world, and then he goes on to do Job describes God doing in the book of Job, establishing the foundations, creating the law and the order, day and night, all those kinds of things that are described about Yahweh in the book of Job. But then Marduk takes Kingu, and he squeezes him. And each drop of blood of Kingu becomes a human being. And that explains why we're so wicked. Because we're made from the blood of Kingu. But anyway, a lot of scholars, liberal scholars anyway, believe that the story in Genesis is based on the Enuma Elis. Only they've tried to take the mythology out. They demythologized the story. There's no combat between Yahweh in the book of Genesis, and there's no combat between God and this force out here. There's no Tiamat, but there is Tiham. And a lot of scholars believe Tiham was a derivative of Tiamat. Tiham, the Hebrew word, means formless void. So we've gotten from a female dragon that wants to suck all light back into her to a sort of an abstraction, a formless void. And of course, since there's no resistance, God says, let there be light. God, before that, God broods over the face of the water. If you read the King James Version, the Spirit of God broods over the face of the water. And then says, let there be light, and there's light. So there's no fighting, no combat. Only the great dragon has become an abstraction, a formless void. And instead of hacking things apart and separating everything with a sword, in the Genesis story, if you drop the word S from sword, you get word. So God creates everything through the word. And the rest of the story in Genesis is God separating and dividing, just like Marduk did, establishing the limits and doing all that kind of thing. These stories are often cited as examples of the transition that was occurring globally, the transition from a matriarchal culture to patriarchal culture. And these stories reflect that shift. Before the Akkadians from the north invaded the Fertile Crescent, the Sumerians, not the Samaritans, but the Sumerians were living there. They were agriculturalist people. They were living pretty much in peace, and they worshipped a great goddess by the name of Inanna. And some scholars believe that Tiamat was a demonization of the goddess Inanna. They demonized her. They turned her into a great big dragon who sucks life and light back into her body. So these stories not only reflect that shift from matriarchal culture to patriarchal culture, they also reflect an attempt, in my opinion, an attempt to demonize the great mother goddess on the one hand, and on the other hand, to sort of repress her into an abstraction of the formless void. And that was happening all over the globe, as I said, even in Greece, ancient Greece. And from this book, or no, from Jane Harrison's book, a quote from her book, What Was Happening in Ancient Greece to the Goddesses. She who made all things, gods and mortals alike, is become their plaything, their slave. Dowered only with physical beauty, the goddesses are sequestered to a servile domesticity. They become abject and amorous. In short, they become beauty queens. If you look behind the Judgment of Paris, which appears on the surface as a beauty contest, no, it's not a beauty contest behind that. It's three great goddesses, Athena, Hera, and Aphrodite, who reigned supreme in the world before Homer came along. It's fairly well established these days that the earliest deities on record were not male deities, but female deities, goddesses. Goddesses reigned supreme long before male gods came along. There's a book, if you're interested in reading about that aspect, it's called In the Wake of the Goddess, Women, Culture, and the Transformation of Pagan Mythologies. And let's see if I can get this name right. The author is Tekra Frymer Kinski. Wake of the Goddess. In that book, she talks about that goddesses preceded male gods. So this morning, I'd like to invite you on a short journey of adventure to explore and research the figure of the great mother goddess from the perspective of Jungian depth psychology. That is, as an archetype of the collective unconscious. I know that's a mouthful. I'm going to try my best to explain what those terms mean so we can get on with the show. Carl Jung was a Swiss psychologist who studied with Freud, broke away from Freud because he thought Freud was too involved in just the sexual theory. Everything goes back to sex, biological. So Jung developed his theories of depth psychology, which means the exploration of the unconscious, going deep, going behind the surface, going deep. He coined that term archetype, not only to just coin a new word, but to try to explain certain forms of human behavior that were rooted deep in the psyche, that are not part of the ego and consciousness, but go deep down in the psyche. It was A.W. Auden, I believe, who said, we are lived by powers, we pretend to understand. We are lived by powers we pretend to understand. You know, we assume that ego consciousness is in control of everything. So archetype describes this power, this energy that is in the psyche. Maybe we're conscious of it, maybe we're not. It's like an imprint, though, from experiences that are recurrent in every human life. Like, for example, every human experiences birth. Every human experiences mother. Every human on this planet has experienced a gravity. So those kinds of experiences are what form the archetypes, and they're collective. Everyone shares those archetypes. They're in the collective unconscious. Think of it this way. Think of consciousness as an island, and the surface is above the water. That's consciousness. Well, you know below that there's a landmass. So you look below the surface of consciousness, you find the personal unconscious. But then if you look below that, you realize that this whole landmass is all connected in one. And that's what you can call the collective unconscious. We all share out of that source and that energy and that power of the collective unconscious. Even though we're tiny islands, you know that saying, no man is an island, no person is an island. If we go deep enough, we realize we're all connected. Every human is connected at that deeper level. So anyway, that's my best shot at trying to explain. I hope I did a fairly good job. Archetypes of the collective unconscious. So with that in mind, we take a look at one of the, if not the most powerful archetype of them all, and that's the mother archetype. That's the one experience we all have. And it may be positive or it may be negative. You know, I know people who hate their mothers. I know people who were abandoned by their mothers. I know two people at least, young people, when they were children, their mother left them. And it's had a profound effect on their lives. So we all have that some experience with mother. And so in Jung's mind, that was the most powerful archetype on earth. The mother archetype. First of all, the mother archetype represents and symbolizes the oneness of all of life. She represents the unity of life and the idea of life itself before it's broken apart and separated with this sword and these words into this and that, into an animal kingdom and a plant kingdom and a human kingdom. Before all that, the great mother represents the oneness of all of life. And if you go back into some primitive tribes, I don't mean that in a pejorative way. That's the way they see the world. Everything is one. You know, the Aboriginal Australians say the same blood that flows in our veins is the same blood that courses through all of life. It's the same. So you still find that primal belief around. She also represents the oneness of life and the source of all life. She's the matrix from which all of life came. In her earliest images, she is the mother of even all of the gods. She gave birth to all of the gods. Now, this idea slipped into Christianity in some of the icons in the Renaissance period. Now, I know you can't see this. I wish I could put it up on the screen so you could see it. But this is a little triptych that someone made of Mary. And you see Mary here. It's called the Virge Overante, the closed virgin. She's closed. You see her? She's got a ball in one hand, Jesus in the other. But then you open her up. She's a triptych. She's got three sides. Open her up, and inside there's God and Jesus and all the saints and bishops of the church. And the author says, seen from outside, the Virge Overante is a familiar and unassuming mother with child, but when opened, she reveals the heretical secret within her. So the statue was considered heretical because it implied that everything came from the great mother. So she sneaks in, you know, every now and then she sneaks back in. We try to repress her, we try to demonize her, but she's going to sneak back in. So I invite you today to celebrate a different kind of Mother's Day, a day to recognize the archetypal great mother. As Esther Harding says, we have a way of being quite sentimental and uncritical about our relationship with mother. The great mother is a complex figure with many facets. And we could spend a lot of time, we could take a whole semester course on the great mother, or probably a whole year. She includes not only birth, but growth, maturity, and eventually death, a return into the womb of the great mother. There's also prints in here of sarcophagus in Egypt, where Isis, the great goddess, is painted on the bottom of the casket. She's painted on the bottom of the sarcophagus because of the idea when you die, you return, your energy goes back to the great mother. So she's source of life, source of growth, source of maturity. So there are two vital aspects that I chose that I'd like to just spend the rest of the time talking about concerning the great mother. And one has to do with the maternal instinct in every woman. And the other has to do with the struggle and the conflict of letting go of mother, the children, the offspring, and the mother letting go of them, and them letting go of the mother. So those two are the things I want to finish up talking about. The great mother goddess, according to Esther Harding, represents, among other things, the maternal instinct in every woman. Every woman has the maternal instinct. As instinctual, the archetypal mother is not is transpersonal. She doesn't belong to the woman. She's a power within the woman, but she's not a creation of the ego or consciousness. She was there before you got there, so to speak, as an archetype. In the I and not I dichotomy, she's the not I. You know, Paul says, not I, but Christ who lives in me. So every woman would say, well, not I, but the maternal instinct that lives in me and works through me. The problem occurs when a particular mother, according to Esther Harding, claims the maternal instinct as her own creation. This results in the Jungian concept of identification. To identify with the archetype results in the loss of the woman's own personal identity, and she becomes only and just a mother. You know, when I was in seminary, I did some chaplaincy in a hospital down in Atlanta, Georgia, when I was at Emory, and there was a wing with elderly women in it, and I noticed that not only were they struggling with their physical illness, but they were on the whole depressed. And I'll never forget what one of them said to me. She said to me, my children are grown up and gone. I don't have anyone to clean for or cook for or anything. She said, I have no reason to be living. You know, and I felt for that woman because for her, motherhood was the only thing. It was the only thing she identified with. She had nothing else. So for her, the loss of motherhood was just the loss of the meaning and purpose of living. So I witnessed that identification Jung was talking about it. I witnessed it firsthand. She had become nothing but a mother. And her personality is sacrificed to the archetypal image that usurps the place of her individuality. In this case, a mother will always need someone to mother. She can never stop being a mother, for that's the only role she knows, the only identity she has ever had. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not, or neither is Esther Harding, degrading motherhood. Motherhood is a sacred thing. One of the most important things, I think, that the things that Esther Harding points out is that the concept of love, that we speak of love, she says it doesn't come out of the sexual instinct. It doesn't come out of, true love doesn't come out of the play between the sexes. It comes out of the mother-child relationship. You know, and that made me think, well, you know, maybe that's why the Greeks differentiated between philios, eros, and agape. Agape was the love that a mother has for her child, and the child's love for the mother. And she said, that's the precursor of what we call love, not sex, not sexuality. I think that's very important to know. She goes on to say, for women who identify with the role of the maternal instinct, the realization that the maternal instinct must take its place as one and only one of the fundamental motives on which the complete human personality is based. So you're not just a mother, and neither are fathers, just fathers. Those are one of the components of development of personality. You know, and I was thinking of what would be an analogy on the male part for a man who identifies completely with his sexual instinct. Well, we have a word in our culture for that. It's called playboy, right? And that's a very appropriate term because you're a boy. You're a playboy. You'll never become a man. You'll be a playboy all your life under the compulsion of the sexual instinct. You're not you. You're governed by your sexual instinct. There's no you there. You're just guided wherever. You remember that scene in the Dead Poets Society where the guy's walking like that? And he says, well, we know where he's going, you know. So, yeah, that's an analogy of on the male side of a man who completely identifies with his sexual instinct. He's nothing but a fertilizer. Remember that story, Peter Pan, where Peter Pan, you know, he gets the boys and Wendy and they fly off to Never Never Land where, what? The boys never have to grow up. And look at that story. They make Wendy their mother. She has to read stories to them every night. When she doesn't want to and she goes home, Peter gets violent. Because he wants to stay a boy as long as he can. Never have to grow up. You know, we struggle with this. Men struggle with this. I struggle with it. Okay, let's move on. This is a quote from Carl Jung. The most immediate primordial image is the mother, for she is in every way the nearest and most powerful experience, and the one, moreover, that occurs in the most impressionable period of a person's life. Since the conscience is as yet weakly developed in childhood, one cannot speak of an individual experience at all. The mother, however, is an archetypal experience. She is known by the more or less unconscious child, not as a definite individual feminine personality, but as the mother, an archetype loaded with significant possibilities. The first word out of a baby's mouth is ma. The world over, in every language, ma. It's so important, it's reduplicated, mama. First word, mama. First experience, mother. The experience is so deep that the infant doesn't see as an infant. The infant sees self as just one with mother. Long before the father had any great importance for the child, the mother was present, the most significant, the most inescapable fact in life. So for earthly mothers, the struggle is to avoid identification with the archetype, which leads directly to letting go of the offspring, the sons and the daughters. But for the child, the most important and often filled with conflict and pain is letting go of mother. And that's why, in primitive cultures, some of the initiation ceremonies for little boys are very cruel. know. Very cruel. Because it's a very tough experience to let go of that emotional bond with mother, to find your own identity, to be your own person and become an adult, a responsible adult, without clinging to mother's apron strings. The child's emancipation from the personal mother and the recognition of the necessary transformation and to transition to becoming a responsible adult is accompanied by these cruel rites. Joseph Campbell says, if you want to know how grown-up men do not grow up, how boys don't grow up, read the New York Times in America. Because we have no rituals to help our boys become men. Very few. Very few. My first one was being inducted in the United States Marine Corps in 1969 when I got out of high school. We got off the bus in Parris Island, and the drill instructor said, I am your mother. I said to myself, no, you're not my mother. And he says, I'm going to be your mother for the next 8 weeks. And I think back on that, and I think, well, you know, that's what that was. That was an attempt to separate us, sever that emotional bond from mother, from personal mother, and help us to grow into adult men. But then I was thinking before that. I remembered going to Hendersonville High School, and the seniors would always wait out in the hallway while the underclass people went into the assembly room, and we would come in marching and singing the anthem of Hendersonville High School. We have any Hendersonville High School graduates here? Hail to the red and white. Hail to our alma mater. And I thought, well, now I could define all those other words, but what is alma mater? So I looked it up. Does anybody know what it means? Nourishing mother. So I thought, oh, wow, here again, we're finding her. She's sneaking her way back in. She's our alma mater. Now, see, people say, well, that's a figure of speech. It's not a figure of speech. It's a figure of power and force and energy. It comes out of the collective unconscious. We're going to find mother somewhere. We're going to find the universal mother somewhere. You know, every cathedral in France is called Notre Dame. Yes. Matra Ecclesiae, the church, is mother. Mother Mary. She keeps coming back. Why? Because she's deep within the psyche of all of us, and she won't be repressed. She won't be put down. She keeps coming back. And for us children of mothers, sons or daughters, the struggle will be to honor our mothers, but to somehow sever that emotional bond so that we can become adult men. Now, one thing I want to be clear before I come to a close here, and that is, you know, none of us are perfect. None of us are perfect. And I'm not up here saying, you know, you should do this and you should be that, and I'm not passing judgment. We're all struggling. We're all struggling in some way, shape, or form to become responsible adult people. To sever the bond to mother, or maybe even to somehow reconcile with a mother who we feel neglected or abandoned us. We're all struggling in that. So the point is not that we're perfected. The point is that we contemplate about that. We think about it. She keeps coming back. We try to get rid of her, but she keeps coming back. In the biblical story, she reappears in Proverbs chapter 8, and she says, when God created the world, I was with him. And her name is Sophia, wisdom. When God created the world, I was by his side. I was crafting. And that makes me think that God said it, but she crafted it. God said it, but the mother goddess crafted it. That's Proverbs 8, if you want to go back and read it. About her. She crops up again with Mother Mary. And from the triptych I showed you, that Mother Mary, when this person was able to let the archetype speak, it spoke. Mother Mary was the container of God, Christ, the church, and all. So I think as we celebrate Mother's Day, let's celebrate it in a different kind of way. Let's recognize not only and honor our not only our biological personal mothers, but let's pay attention and pay homage to the great Mother Goddess of all of life. Thank you. Now, in my church, when I was in the Methodist church, they had a clock on the wall back there, and I could always tell what time it was. And I thought, well, why do they have it back there? Because they can't see it. I'm the only one who can see it. Then I thought, okay, yes, they wanted me to see it.